always feel like agriculture is this amazing gift of a field, because I feel like there's nothing that you're interested in that you can't find a home in agriculture, which is why I love it so much.
Welcome to Spur of the Moment, the podcast of Colorado State University's Spur Campus in Denver, Colorado.
A farmer in California is going to be very different than like somebody in Alabama raising watermelon or sweet potato or field peas, right? So I'm often thinking about how do we ensure that no one gets left behind as we think about this new future of agriculture.
On this podcast, we talk with experts in food, water, health, and sustainability, and learn about their current work and their career journeys. I'm Jocelyn Hiddle, Associate Vice Chancellor of the CSU Spur Campus, and I'm joined today by Lakeisha Odom, the Scientific Program Director for the Foundation for Food and Agricultural Research, where she's been since 2016. Dr. Odom is committed to promoting the use of innovative science and interdisciplinary thinking to tackle today's complex challenges in food and agriculture. Prior to her work with FFAR, Dr. Odom held positions in the US EPA in the Office of Research and Development and the Brownfields Redevelopment Program. Dr. Odom was also an early career intern for the Public Policy Board of the American Phytopathological Society and a AAAS Science and Technology Policy Fellow at the USDA Biotechnology Regulatory Service, where she managed a diverse portfolio which included working with the OECD Working Group for the Harmonization of Regulatory Oversight in Biotechnology. And I know we're going to talk more about all of that. Lakeisha received her bachelor's degree from Tuskegee University, her master's degree from the George Washington University, and her doctorate from Tuskegee University. Welcome, Dr. Odom.
Thank you so much for having me.
I'm excited to dive a little deeper into all of these experiences. As I was reading your bio, I was thinking, oh my goodness, so many different things, such a journey, and I'm interested to hear more about them. But maybe we can start with, what is a day in the life like for you right now?
Right now at the Foundation for Food and Ag Research, or FAR, I am a scientific program director. And what that consists of is a mixture of things. So there's identifying new areas for research. So we look for gaps. The foundation is based on developing and increasing research funding through public-private partnerships. So it's very often I'm building relationships. I'm engaging with industry, NGOs, international partners. We also award grants. So we've awarded about 360 grants since our inception, and that's about $713 million, I believe, total. And so that's a lot of managing those grantees. And so it's constantly either managing, looking for the next exciting idea, developing fellowships, which is something else that I do within FAR. I manage our workforce development. So it's, if you can't tell from my resume, I like a lot of different experiences and I like new challenges. And so FAR often offers me lots of opportunities to explore and learn and continue to grow as a professional.
Can you say more about some of the big projects that you and your team are focused on right now?
Absolutely. So right now we are funding a number of exciting projects, and some of them I will talk about tomorrow at the conference. Ecosystem services is something that we're really quite excited about. We funded a larger project called Open Team that focuses on interoperability of data and increasing decision support tools. And then I would say some of the other projects that I'm quite excited about are around DEI in the soil health space. So they're not necessarily our biggest dollar amounts, but I think they're quite exciting. So understanding perspectives of BIPOC or Black and Indigenous farmers and ranchers, recognizing that the needs for them as far as we think about adoption and technical assistance and support might be a bit different, right? The profile of farmers and ranchers is different. And so we recognize that we know some about a particular profile, but not necessarily like what are women ranchers in Arizona thinking about, for example, and what do they need and what are their research needs? So one of the things that FAR is really committed to is looking at the needs across commodities, specialty crops, but also size and scale of operation. And I'm from Alabama and I come from a history of subsistence farming. And so for me, I'm always thinking about like, what would my grandfather respond to, right? Where would he get his information and what would he need? And so it's not always the same thing, right? A farmer in California is going to be very different than like somebody in Alabama raising watermelon or sweet potato or field peas, right? So I'm often thinking about how do we ensure that no one gets left behind as we think about this new future of agriculture?
Absolutely. It's so interesting to think about the transects of diversity within agriculture are various, right? You've got different geographies. You have different crops or commodities. You have different weather patterns. You have different amounts of water. You have different soil types. All of these things require a more tailored approach than some other industries might. Just the diversity of circumstance is pretty intense.
That's what makes agriculture so exciting to me, though, is that there are so many different factors, but also so many people that are just committed to trying to feed the world and protect their environment, protect their water, protect their soil, and protect a legacy. And something about that is so beautiful to me.
There is something to our agriculturalists are the real stewards of our lands and have been for generations, right? So there's real, that legacy piece is so critical to so many people.
Absolutely. And I think that as we think about issues around labor and workforce and robotics and so many other challenges are really making it difficult right now, I think. But I don't sense any less passion or commitment to agriculture. So one of the things, though we are a research funding organization, one of the things I take pride in is we're coming up with solutions or trying to come up with innovations that will make this important, hard job potentially easier, more profitable, more accessible. But I think that's part of the reason why I get so excited about the work that I get to do.
You also mentioned ecosystem services as something that you and your team are focused on. Can you tell us, what does that mean for someone who might not be familiar with that term?
So we use the term ecosystem services to describe any additional service that our land provides us, right? So if you're thinking about if you protect your soil, you reduce the amount of a chance for erosion or runoff, right? If you think about when it heavy rains and then you just see soil running everywhere, right? But if you keep something on the land, cover crops or some cropping, then you tend to break that down or you reduce that. So ecosystem services are just these multitudes of additional services that are provided many times through agricultural practices. The challenging part is that they are not often valued. And so what you have is you have producers that are adopting some really interesting and innovative environmentally conscious practices, but they're kind of doing it on their own. They're not really getting support for it financially, some through federal programs, but not nearly to compensate. And those additional beneficial characteristics or practices they adopt enable us to do things like sequester carbon from the environment or protect our water sources. So it's a gift in a way, right? But it is a gift that has a cost. And so much of what I think we wanted to try to fund and support is figuring out how we can identify sound, clear, researchable, evidence-based decisions that would enable farmers and ranchers to adopt practices that not only are profitable, but also are beneficial to the environment, right? I think sometimes we feel like you can have either or, but I think with certain sets of practices, definitely within soil health and water management, you can have the best of both worlds. But it is an investment and it is a different way of being, and that has a cost. And so is there a way for us to monetize that and provide resources or some sort of compensation for those producers that are adopting those practices?
So for just to use an example, maybe to highlight what you're talking about, a farmer has a crop that they plant over the course of the summer and then they harvest it. And then they might plant another crop that holds the soil in place that doesn't make them any money. They pay some money to actually put that crop in the ground. It doesn't make them any money, but it keeps all that soil from running off into the river that then the water utility, for example, has to do less treatment, or the water is cleaner for the environment in general. So what you're looking at is how can you pay the farmer back essentially for the cost that they incur that other people reap the benefits of?
Absolutely. And I think that's always a struggle with environmental issues, is that it's kind of a tragedy of the commons, right? These resources belong to everyone and no one. So if a small group of folks are doing things to protect them in a way that is within their purview to do, right? How do we enable them to continue to do that?
That's really important. So tell me a little bit about the team that's around you doing this work. What kinds of skills do you need on your team?
It's pretty exciting because our team is comprised of not just scientists, right? Yes, you have scientific program directors, scientific program associates and assistants and officers. That's our science team. But on each of our teams, we also have a grant person, at least one person in communications, folks in development to help us to identify partnerships and build those relationships so that we can fund. So actually, we have a pretty multi-talented team. So I think any expertise in any space around either the scientific side, but if you love communications, that's a space for you. If you really love figuring out how to develop relationships, development team could be awesome. And then our grants team. So if you like numbers or making sure that documents are accurate. So I always feel like agriculture is this amazing gift of a field because I feel like there's nothing that you're interested in that you can't find a home in agriculture, which is why I love it so much.
Yeah. And you may not know this, but the CSU Spur campus, a lot of what we're focused on is trying to introduce people to careers in food and agriculture, water, health, and sustainability. And so I agree with you. There's a wide variety of careers within agriculture. You could fly a drone. You can be an analyst of really intense data sets, big data sets. You can be a writer and a communicator. You can be a filmmaker. All of these things are really part of agriculture. And it sounds like even just part of your team.
I recently was at a meeting where they were talking about future workforce needs in agriculture. And I saw this statistic that made me very sad, which is only about 3% of millennials consider agriculture as a career path. And I just feel like there's so much opportunity that we don't often think about, right? And so there's a very specific view of what agriculture is. And I'm from Alabama. I'm a Black woman from Alabama. I know what people feel about agriculture. And I did my dissertation work in cotton. So my whole family was like, we did all this work to send you to school to get you out of agriculture. And here you are again. But I absolutely adore it. It has been the most rich experience. I never fail to find new things to love, to explore, and to learn in this space. And you're feeding people, like you're taking care of the world.
Yeah, it's nourishing on all fronts, right?
Absolutely. I love that. Yes, that's what it is.
So let's talk a little bit about your work on the diversity side of things. You've talked a little bit about it, but maybe you can be a bit more specific. You said 3% of millennials are interested in going into agriculture. What does that look like when you start to break it down across different racial and ethnic groups? And what are you doing to try to get more of those folks into agriculture?
It looks like I'm a little concerned at who will be at the table, right? I often say this, where I'm often in conversations or asked to speak around sustainability and regenerative ag. And for me, those are the future, right? We're talking about sustaining the world for the future. But very often, there aren't a lot of women in the room. There aren't a lot of people of color in the room. So I'm a little worried sometimes when we're talking about the future, how are these voices not in the room, right? If you're not in the room, how are you weighing in on what the future should look like in these spaces, given especially in the U.S., agriculture just has a very storied past with minorities. But I don't think that that's a reason for us to stay away from ag. I think there's a reason for us to engage more in this space. So some of the things that we are funding, we have a couple of fellowships that I'm pretty excited about that we've gotten off the ground. One is with the Native American Agriculture Fund, and that is looking at bringing more Indigenous students into agriculture. One is a pretty exciting one with the Kirshner Foundation, where we're looking at HBCU students, historically Black colleges and universities, but we're training them on how to engage with venture capital, because that's just a space that's another opportunity that people don't think of that does exist, right? And so a number of scientists that I know now are tiptoeing into that space, and I think that's very exciting. And there's also a lot of venture capital interest in agricultural research right now. So helping students even understand that that is a possibility. I don't know if this stat is accurate, but I think it's like less than 1 or 2% of venture capitalists, anything, is a person of color or woman. And so finding these opportunities to just expose, like you're doing here, right? And so much of it is just, if I don't see myself there, I don't think it's possible for me to be there. But if I see me there, and I've had so many students walk up to me and just say, you look like me, you know, and that makes them feel like this is a space that they can work in and thrive and be excited and give, right? And contribute to the world.
Yeah, it's so important for people to be able to see themselves in these career paths. So thank you for the work that you're doing to ensure that they see more people like them and that we're continuing to keep doors and options open. Let's talk about some of the challenges in your day. What are some of the bigger challenges? How do you get around them? And is there anyone that you call for help?
Oh, yes. There's a group chat in WhatsApp. That's all they're there for. I think sometimes the hardest challenge for me is sometimes maintaining that joy. You know, life is hard lately. And ag is hard. And some of the things that you recognize that we're up against feel sometimes insurmountable. I mean, that's just the truth. So you think about the IPCC reports, when you read about climate change, when you read about, you know, we're losing land. And when you hear about all of these things, just in agriculture, not all the other things in the world. But, you know, that is sometimes a part that I struggle with, because when you look at the enormity of it, it feels like, what can one person do, right? And then I send a bunch of text messages in my group chat and remind myself, right, that there are so many people that are committed and passionate and intelligent and capable and competent. And we're all thinking about the same things and partnering in some really unique ways lately that I haven't seen. And that gives me a lot of hope. And that kind of brings me back.
One last question in the day in the life, and then I do want to talk a bit about your history, how you got where you are. You know, I think we all maybe have days, I hope we all have days or moments where we think, I was just good at my job. What has just happened for you when you have that thought?
So I recently had the opportunity to participate in a Climate Underground virtual meeting. I was asked to participate, and it's a really cool event. It's been going on for about 3 years now, and it's sponsored by Vice President Al Gore. And so I was like, yes, I'm invited. I will be on this panel. And also on this panel was Dr. Ratan Lal, who is a person that I cited religiously during my PhD. So now I'm on a panel with Dr. Ratan Lal. And I didn't realize this because I don't often read all my emails, but Vice President Gore was moderating. And I did not know that until I got on camera.
That's quite a surprise.
And I was like, oh, I should pay attention to details. But I probably, it's better that I didn't, because I would have freaked out. I was just like, yeah, it's great. It's great. I'm good. And it was just this amazing moment of a person that, like, I read their work religiously when I was doing my own research. And we're on a panel together, and we met before, but I was just like, man, Dr. Ratan Lal knows my name. And then Vice President Gore said my name. So for me, like, I think that was probably like, wow, this is pretty cool.
Yeah.
And then I think the next week I had a chance to go to Tuskegee and at their Professional Agriculture Workers Conference, got to talk, like, I got to see the folks that, you know, and I went there for undergrad. So some of these people knew when I was 18 years old, and to be able to present to them and talk to them about possibilities and talk to the students, that, right. So I don't know which one is higher or lower, but mm-hmm. they both are pretty, yeah. pretty cool.
That sounds like a good sort of 1-2 punch of experiences, yeah. particularly the sense that, you know, you were on a panel with someone that you were looking up to, and then you got to go and sort of reach a hand back to the younger generation.
Absolutely.
At the same time. So it's a nice moment.
Within like 3 days of mm-hmm. each other, because one happened on Friday and then I left for Saturday for the conference. So it was like back to back. I was like, oh, this is great. I'm killing it this week.
We all have also moments that don't feel that way.
Yes.
So we're not going to talk about those today, but I have one question for you. It's one of our spur of the moment questions. So when you were 4 or 5, what did you want to be when you grew up?
I think I wanted to be a judge.
Excellent.
I don't even know if I knew what one was, but I felt like that was a thing I should do.
There you go. I think a lot of us when we're 4 or 5 don't have a clear concept of what a job actually is. Okay, so let's go back a little bit. Can you tell us in kind of the broad brushstrokes how it is that you got to where you are?
I think I often say that I'm just a person who chases really complex things, right? I like challenges. That's just a thing that really excites me, is figuring out complex situations. So I think I started out in environmental science, and then I was like, oh, I got a fellowship and decided to go to EPA and was there for a couple of years, and then got my master's there. And then I said, well, this is window of time where I think I might want to go back and get my PhD. And part of that was I was in a policy space, but I was in offices with a lot of people that were making policies that were quite scientific, but they didn't necessarily have scientific background. And so I was like, well, if I really like this space and I think I want to stay in this space, I feel like I need to go back and get this undergirding. And I'd already had a fascination for genetically modified crops, crop breeding, soil science. So I had already had a lot of, even though I was an environmental science student, I came up through the ag school. So a lot of my classes were ag classes. And so I said, well, if I want to go back and get a PhD, this could be really cool. And so I decided to do that and study the impact of a genetically modified cotton that had been designed. It had a synthetic peptide, and more, I wanted to know the effect of it on the environment, right? Mm-hmm. So I wanted to know the impact on soil health and on enzymatic activity. And then after that, I'd heard about the AAAS policy fellowship. And I said, well, this sounds like a thing that's made for me. And so I ended up going to USDA. And I thought, this is it. This is where I'm going to go. Federal. That's all I want to be. And then I was like, no, maybe not. And this is one of those moments that I'll share that wasn't so great. So I thought I was going to get a position with the USDA, and I did not. And I did not have another plan for my life. So I was a little bit like, what is happening? And this position came across when I was doing job searches. And I was like, no. And then another friend said it to me, and I was like, no, I don't think this is a good fit for me. I don't know about nonprofit. And then I had another friend, like, the people kept calling me like, you need to apply for the job. And I was like, I don't know. I don't think so. And then I had a friend call and say, apply today. I was like, fine, I'll apply. And then the executive director at the time called me, because the way they wrote the position description wasn't accurate. Once she described the job, I wanted the job, right? So I say that to say, like, sometimes your original plan, you're not exactly where you think you might need to be, but you end up in a better place. This is the best job for me. I mean, I think there are skill sets that I've discovered in myself and capabilities that just a job like this calls it out, right? It's a nonprofit. We're a smaller organization. You kind of have to have multiple hats and wear multiple hats. Surprise, surprise. I like hats. So it works for me. And so then after I got to the foundation was really where I realized that all these seemingly disparate opportunities or experiences made me really well suited for this position. So it's been amazing. So I always encourage folks, even if you don't think you'll like it, talk to somebody that does. Call them up, find them on LinkedIn, just ask them, will they give you 10, 15 minutes of their time? Most of the time they will, surprisingly enough. And ask them exactly what you're asking me, because there are probably some things that you don't know that you would love because you haven't been exposed to them yet.
I forget the book that that outlines this, how people are particularly bad at predicting what's going to make them happy in the future. But a much better way to, a more accurate way to assess whether or not somebody's going to make you happy is to talk to somebody who is in that position or who has made that decision. So I think your advice is great. Can you talk to someone who's in that space and have that help inform what your next step might be, even if it's something unexpected?
I encourage it all of the time, because there's no way to know sometimes just reading a position description or just articulating even what that job is. Like, if I, before I had the job of scientific program director, I had no idea what that meant. I was like, I do something with science and programming, but I had no real idea, like, the breadth of experience that I would have or be exposed to. And I think the only way you know sometimes is to take that internship, do the thing that scares you a little bit, right? Because that might be the most exciting thing.
Well, and it seems to me that it is frequently the case that the person who comes into that role then shapes that role, right? So it's not just, do you understand what it is now, but what is it that you're bringing that turns it into something that is a little bit different? So can we talk a little bit about some of your experiences? So I saw in your bio that while you were getting your doctorate, you are a CREATE Eigert Fellow. That is an acronym, I have no doubt, but I don't know that you need to spell out exactly what all of those letters mean. But tell us what the actual fellowship was.
So the fellowship was a partnership between Tuskegee University and UC Davis, and it gave us an opportunity to kind of share learnings. They could come to our campus. We could go to their campus. I'll be fair and say we probably went to their campus more. And also they had a relationship with Chagas, which is an agricultural institution in Ireland. And also I think it was Dublin University, where some of the students, if they would like to, could go there for a set amount of time. And I decided the second I heard about this that I was going to Ireland and I was going to work with this one particular researcher. I looked him up and I fixated on him. I don't know why. And they told me, no, Lakeisha, you can't go this year. And I was like, yeah, I'm going to Ireland. Like, I kept saying, I got a passport. Nobody told me I was going anywhere. I was just like, I am going. And then like about 8 months later, somebody was called, the UC Davis called and said, do you still want to go? Absolutely. And do you want to work? And I wanted to work with you. And when I got there, they assigned me someone else, but I was supposed to work on a potato project and my seeds didn't come in time. I said, oh, well, while my seeds come in, I'll just go work in Ewan's lab. And so I just kind of weaseled my way in there. And once I got in, I refused to leave. And they would see me, the other folks would see me say, oh, the person that was supposed to be our intern. I was like, sorry. And it was one of the most amazing experiences of my life, just getting to see how research is done in a different place. And in a different, their PhD program is very different than ours, right? So we have to do so many hours of classwork prior to going to the lab. They go straight into the lab. Mm-hmm. Their programs are a bit shorter, a bit more intensive, but I loved it. And I've been back to Ireland like once or twice since then, just because I fell in love with the country.
So you talked a little bit about maybe a partial answer to this question, but have there been transitions along the way that have been particularly difficult? Transitions?
I feel like for me, I often struggle with transitions. As much as I enjoy it on the back end, the change in the beginning is also sometimes very like disruptive to me. But I would say probably the harder shift was when I got to FAR. I remember distinctly, like I was asked to design an event. It was like my first month. And I went into the executive director's office and I said, do you want to see this list? Do you approve who, you know, comes to this meeting? And she looked at me, she's like, no. And then I remember going back in my office, I sat down, I was like, I'm now the decider. and it just gobsmacked me. I was like, oh, I now decide the things. And it took me a while to get really confident in that. I mean, the reality is that I was younger in my profession. I'm a woman. I have a little voice. I'm not very tall. And so walking into these rooms with people that have been doing this work longer than I had been alive, and I now have to give them something or move them in some way. And for me, it took a while to find all my superpowers, right? I have a number of them. They're not like anybody else's. And at first I was like, am I going to be very good at this job? Because I'm not doing it the way I see other people doing it. But it is perfect for me. It is just right for my personality.
Definitely getting that. I should note that Dr. Odom is here to speak as part of the CSU Spurwater and the West Symposium. So I'm very much looking forward to hearing more about your work during your remarks. Anyone who was particularly influential? Teachers, bosses, coworkers?
Absolutely. I think definitely mentors from graduate school. I always talk about Dr. Linnell Ogden. I only had one class with this woman, but she said, like, certain people will say things that just stick in my brain and they then become post-it notes that I carry everywhere I go. So there are probably three people I think about that have said things. So Dr. Linnell Ogden told me, don't get upset when they give you more work. That means you know how to do more things. And it just reminded me, now that's a slippery slope. Let's be honest, as a woman, like, you got to balance that out. But there were so many things that I took on because I thought it would be interesting or exciting. And later, they were really great additions to my toolkit later in my career. And then Dr. Luther Williams, he was an ex-provost at Tuskegee, used to tell us to be unapologetically great. And I write that down. And it is on a post-it everywhere I have ever been since then. And then Dr. A. Dolores Alexander, one of my mentors from Tuskegee, used to tell me, you got to row your own hoe. Don't look at what somebody else is doing or how they're doing it or their pace. That's not your concern. You have to focus on what you're doing because it's really hard sometimes and you start to compare. Mm-hmm. And that is just the worst thing that you could ever do because you don't get to develop your own skill sets because you're trying to pantomime somebody else's, right? And I think as a woman, especially for me, I was like, I have to sound this way and I have to be, you know, I don't know what I was trying to be, but it wasn't me. So for a while, I was like, no, I think I can do this as me. And when I started to do this work and move through the world completely as me and unapologetically me, it really got easy.
So this might be related, but if you were going to give a 15-year-old some advice, what would you say? And then maybe a 25-year-old.
I think I would tell most people much of what I've been saying now, which is you have your own superpowers. Everybody has gifts and the world will make room for your gifts. I believe that 100%. And so don't waste so much time worrying about the gift you don't have and develop the gifts that you do have. And there will be a space for you, right? I thought, oh, I can't be bubbly and silly as a scientist. I must be stern. That never really felt right for me, right? And over the years, I've been told like my presentation style, like I enjoy the things I do. I laugh, I get excited, and that sometimes excites others. And so those are spaces where I maybe have been told to be more measured and more stern, but I found that that's not my personality and that's not what I bring to the world. So when I come into the room as my full self, I think it allows other people to be their full selves. And that's the best part. So I would say just look for your own special gifts and don't worry if they don't look like anybody else's.
It's interesting. I was having a conversation with a partner of ours recently who's in the K-12 education space. And he said, you know, I got into K-12 education because when I was younger, I looked around and I had this vice principal who just seemed like he was having so much fun at work. And I thought, he's having so much fun. I want to have fun while I work. Maybe I'll look into this. And so it turned out that it was fun for him as well. But I think if you're not having fun and you're not laughing and you're not bringing all of that into it, then, I mean, I think it's inspirational for people to see you laughing and having a good time while you're talking about science and while you're talking about your job.
I have a really fun job. I feel like, and I meet people that have like super cool things that they're doing and problems they're solving, and they seem to really like it.
Yeah. That is what we all aspire to, right? Is having a good time at work. Okay. My second spur of the moment question for you. Do you cook?
Yes.
You're in agriculture. What's your special dish? What are you most proud of?
I'm most proud, I think, of my baking because I am a baker. And so I've been doing this thing. My mom passed away about 2.5 years ago. So I've taken all of her old recipes. And when I tried to make them exactly as she made them, I didn't like them. But I've started to try to like mix them and make like a new recipe based on her traditional recipe. And that's something I'm really proud of.
That's great. I love it. It's a hybridization of the legacy and your innovation.
Absolutely.
I love that.
I love that.
All right. So where can people find more information about FFAR, your work? Are there some websites we can send them to?
Absolutely. So if you type in FFAR and ag, we will come up. FoundationFAR.org, which is really long. That's why I said
just Google. FFAR. Yes.
Yep. And our information is there. And I make this offer to your listeners. If there's anybody that just wants to ask me about my job in more detail, people send me emails about it all the time. I love talking to people about what I've done and learning about what they want to do. So I make that offer. Like if you find me on LinkedIn, I'm there. And just send me a message.
That is an echo of your networking hack. Mm-hmm. If you all have something that Dr. Odom can help you with, she's here for you.
She loves that.
Great. Well, Dr. Odom, it has been an absolute pleasure speaking with you. Thank you so much for your time today. And we look forward to your remarks at the Water in the West Symposium tomorrow. And if anyone is listening and wants to see her remarks, we will be posting those videos at csuspur.org/WITW. That's Water in the West in the coming weeks. So you'll have a chance to see her laughing and having a good time while she talks about science and her job. Thanks so much for being here.
Thank you.
The CSU Spur of the Moment podcast is produced by Kevin Samuelson, and our theme music is by Ketza. Please visit the show notes for links mentioned in this episode. We hope you'll join us in 2 weeks for the next episode. Until then, be well.